I apologize. We have just a bad confluence of schedule conflicts here. And there is at least one member of the committee who's listening to this in their office. So we have the great pleasure today to have the Honorable Susan Leeson, retired justice from the Associate Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and our own David Hendricks, who's acting legislative counsel, to give us a presentation on the Oregon Constitution. And we also are honored to have the mock trial team from Pacific Crest Community School in Northeast Portland, including my very own personal daughter, who is in the back hanging on every word you are about to say. So, I appreciate it. I explained to them that the awkwardness of having to look at your backs while they're here. Usually the people who are teaching them are looking straight at them, so this will be a good learning experience for them. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Senator Burdick. We appreciate being here. My name is Susan Leeson. I'm here with Dave Hendricks. We were asked to do a brief overview of the Oregon Constitution, sort of a constitutional workshop. So please interrupt at any time. My task is to do a general overview, and then Dave is going to talk about some matters involving distribution of powers.
If I could just break in for a second, if there are any pressing questions from the audience here, if somebody cared to write a note and give it to Dale Penn here with questions that you come up with from the audience, I'd be happy to accommodate that. Can't do a lot of them, but can do some good ones. One of the students here came up with the best question on the floor today, so I learned from that. Anyway, go ahead.
That's wonderful. We're going to be referring throughout my presentation to this document, and I'm going to be asking you to thumb along with me, if you will, because constitutional matters are matters of words, and there are significantly different kinds of words in the Oregon Constitution and the United States Constitutions. The pagination is a little strange, but I will refer you both to page and section as we go along. I thought it would be useful to start out with page 21 of the Oregon Constitution, Article 4, Section 31, namely the oath that you took, very similar to the oath that I took as a member of the Oregon Supreme Court, that I will support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon, which might lead a person to ask, why do we need two? Wouldn't one suffice? And what we want to talk about today is why we have separate constitutions, a little bit how they interact, but some of the issues that arise under them both. The fact that we have two constitutions reflects what's called American federalism. You cannot explain it to anybody who didn't grow up with it. In response to the question, who has ultimate governing power, the answer is, don't know. Sometimes it's the states, sometimes it's the national government. That is an ongoing debate, and we see power shifting over time, sometimes with the national government, sometimes power reverts to the states. What I thought would be useful for us to do is look at what some of the major issues were surrounding the adoption of the United States Constitution. That's an 18th century document. The convention met in 1787. At a time when the states had exclusive sovereignty, we weren't without government in 1787. We had 13 perfectly fine governments, thank you, which existed since the time of the American Revolution. Every state drafted a constitution soon after the Revolution or adopted the constitutions they'd been working under. Those were the sovereign governing units. So the major question in 1787 was, where's power going to go? Is it going to stay with the states, or are we giving it over to the national government? The answer to that question in part depended on who or what was represented in the United States government. So the initial question was one of representation. Who ought to be represented, or what ought to be represented? And as we know, there was a compromise. People are represented, but so are the states, considered as sovereign entities at that time. Another question was, how much power ought the national government to have relative to the state governments? Now, here's I'm going to start with referring to the documents. When we look at Article 1, Section 1 of the United States Constitution, it's on page 3 at the back of your materials. We started new pagination with the United States Constitution. Article 1, Section 1, starts out, all legislative powers herein granted. We contrast that with Article 4 of the Oregon Constitution, which starts out, which is on page 15 under the state constitution, the legislative power of the state. We know what it is. You have it. It's plenary. But with respect to the United States Congress, the drafters of the Constitution wanted to limit Congress's powers. So Congress can only do those things that are explicitly granted. And Article 1, Section 8 starts the laundry list of Congress's powers. Whenever Congress enacts legislation, it must identify where its power to legislate comes from. You don't have to do that. Under state constitutions, it's assumed we know what legislative power is, and the legislative power of the state resides with the legislative assembly, except for the initiative and the referendum, of course, which for the most part today we're not going to talk about in its initial piece. So, with respect to the question, who or what ought to be represented, the national government, both states and the people, how much power should the national government have relative to the states, what they chose to give. And finally, how should power be allocated? That was the next big fight in 1787. We've known for thousands of years that governments have to do three things. They have to make laws, they have to execute laws, and they have to judge laws. One person's perfectly capable of doing that. Many people are perfectly capable of doing that. In a pure democracy, the people make, execute, and judge all the laws. So one of the big debates in 1787 was, what's a good way of allocating those powers? And they came up with what they called a new science of politics, the separation of powers, so that Congress does legislative things, the president does executive things, the courts do judicial things. Wasn't always like that. Major departure from the way England, for example, chose to have a relationship between judging and the executive, located in Parliament, the legislative branch. So making the decision that powers ought to be separated into three different branches was considered one of the great constitutional contributions of 1787. Most state constitutions had done that, but not all. There was a real blending of powers in several of the state constitutions. Okay, so those were our 18th century concerns, if you will. As sort of an afterthought, because it became an issue during the ratification debates, on page 9, we see something called a Bill of Rights. Added as amendments to the Constitution, as though those aren't the really important things, they're amendments, they're afterthoughts, they're changes to what we really came to talk about. James Madison agreed to propose them only as a condition of ratification of the United States Constitution. Compare that with the Oregon Constitution. Page 3 of these handout materials. What is government about?
It is about
protecting rights. And so Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, like the first article of most state constitutions, lists the Bill of Rights. They're not afterthoughts. They're the core of what we're here to talk about. Article 1, Section 1, declares that all men, when they form a social compact, are equal in right. The classic statement of social contract theory. Power and rights reside in the people. They enter into agreements with one another to create government. The function of government is to protect these things laid out in the Bill of Rights. So it's a different attitude towards a rights orientation, if you will. When the Oregon Constitutional Convention was called in 1787, or in 1857, they took for granted some of the fights that had been had at the United States Constitutional Convention. And so we have a document that looks conventional in the light of what had happened in the previous century. Now, before we talk about the Oregon Constitution, I've handed out a little four-page piece that does some quick Oregon constitutional history in four periods, taking us up to 1857. That's just for those of you who, like me, are sort of curious, where did we come from anyway? What were some of the issues?
Could you bring some for the table back there? Do you know? Are those back there?
They are.
Yeah, if people want to go grab...
A rush to history on the side table. This is good.
Okay, thank you.
The Oregon Constitutional Convention met for 1 month in August of 1857. The concerns were very different from what they had been in 1787. Our convention consisted of 16 men, 33 farmers, and 18 lawyers, but as all the commentators on the convention point out, the lawyers did most of the talking. The original document had 175 sections. 172 of those were lifted from other constitutions, primarily Indiana, Maine, and Iowa. Why those three states? Because people who had come to Oregon had come from those states, had those laws and those constitutions available to them. The highest form of flattery in this business is lifting someone else's constitutional or statutory provision. The only thing that the Constitutional Convention of Oregon did of its own creation was the judicial branch. And then that was substantially amended by the initiative in 1910. So the one thing they tried to do for themselves didn't last. But everything else they took from some other state has held on pretty well. Now, as I said, the Bill of Rights is the starting point for talking about state constitutional law. There are many provisions of Article 1 that are very, very different from the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution. Let's look at a couple because they may affect your work significantly. On page 3 now of the Oregon Constitution, I'm going to start with Article 1, Section 10. No court shall be secret, but justice shall be administered openly and without purchase, completely and without delay, and every man shall have remedy by due course of law for injury done him in his person, property, or reputation. There's nothing like that in the United States Constitution. What does it mean? I had an opportunity to explore the meaning of that provision in considerable depth in a case called Smothers, which required me to go back, look at the text, the history, the court's cases, which were contradictory, and an effort to try to make some sense of the meaning of Article 1, Section 10. The effort only began in Smothers. By no way was complete in that case. But there is an example of the kind of work that you do and the courts have to do, namely interpreting a provision of the Constitution that has no federal national equivalent. There's another provision, Article 1, Section 20, on the next page, is another good example of a provision that sounds a little bit like something we know from the United States Constitution, but in fact is a very, very different matter. No law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens. That is not an equal protection clause like the 14th Amendment. Why not? First, 1857. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment is addressing a concern that grew out of the Civil War of the 1860s. Article 1, Section 20 is addressing a privilege and immunity matter that is different from the concern of equality of treatment that came out of the Civil War. However, as Dave is going to talk about when he points out how the courts have interpreted Article 1, Section 20, the courts have read in a lot of post-1857 thinking into that provision. But it's a different matter, adopted in a different historical context. So those are a couple of examples of where the Bill of Rights are different from the United States Bill of Rights. You'll also see in our Article 1, four sections dealing with religion. One provision in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. So people were thinking differently in 1857 than they were in 1789 and 1791.
I think it's worth pointing out, too, that we had two very controversial ballot measures passed this last election, they're both being challenged in court, and they're both, one, the gay marriage issue, Measure 36, and the property owner compensation issue, Measure 37, you couldn't ask for more different measures, but they are both being challenged under Article 1, Section 20, the Equal Privileges and Immunities.
That's correct.
They were giving special privileges to one class of people and denying them to another class.
Yes.
So I just wanted
very,
to...
Very good point. This material is historical, but its contemporary relevance is right in front of us. One other provision I'll mention, and then we'll move on. If you look at Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, it, like the First Amendment, refers to free speech, but the wording is substantially different. No law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject, whatever. That's not the wording of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. So should they be interpreted the same? Are they addressing different kinds of concerns? And, of course, the First Amendment doesn't have the follow-up clause, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right. So interpreting the Oregon Constitution poses challenges that are different than if you were working in the United States Congress. All right, so taken for granted in 1857 was Bill of Rights as the starting point. Second, separation of powers. The thing that was debated and debated and debated in 1787 and almost caused the convention to collapse and a few times was simply taken for granted by 1857. In fact, Oregon went so far in its constitution as to say, not only do we acknowledge the separation of powers, but if you look on page 14 of the Oregon Constitution, Article 3, which talks about the distribution of powers, page 13, separation of powers, the powers of the government shall be divided into three separate departments. Okay. And then when we turn the page, we see, again, the emphasis on nobody charged with duties under one of these departments shall exercise any of the functions of the other. There's no similar language in the United States Constitution. This is what James Madison called an example of a parchment barrier. You can't do judicial things because the Constitution tells you you can't do judicial things. The U.S. Constitution doesn't have similar language. Instead, as Madison explains, it's set up in a way that the offices jealously protect the encroachment of other offices. But it's a different dynamic than to have its Constitution say you can only do what the Constitution tells you you can do. Similarly, judges are not to legislate, the governor is not to legislate, etc., except as otherwise expressly provided in this Constitution. So by 1857, separation of powers wasn't just a fascinating theory as it was in 1787. It was taken so seriously that the drafters thought it important to put in Article 3, the provision that the branches must remain separate. Okay. A third thing that was taken for granted in 1857 was an independent judiciary. Another matter that was fought about in 1787. Because those who make laws certainly can make an argument they're in the best position to judge them. After all, they made them. And in England, that's to a great extent the way the work is done. But the fight over whether judging ought to be done in a separate branch occurred in the 18th century, and by the 19th century was a matter that simply wasn't debated anymore. Well, if those things then were taken for granted or weren't controversial in 1857, what was controversial, you might ask? Interest had changed. Strict regulation of corporations is a theme that runs throughout the original Oregon Constitution. You see it virtually on every page. A second concern, keep government small. That may help explain why there's an article on the administrative branch. The drafters wanted to specify just how big this administration can get, and pretty small is the answer. And the other theme that runs throughout this document is frugality, frugality, frugality. They refused to pay for an official reporter. They put strict debt limits on the state. In their debates about how much should we pay our public officials, the answer was, as little as we can get away with and still attract good people.
Well, that one's certainly holding up well.
Some things don't seem to change in Oregon history. Okay. So those were the themes that were pervasive in 1857. Now, a couple of things have changed significantly in terms of power relations between the national government and the state governments. First is the Supremacy Clause in the United States Constitution, Article 6. That proved very controversial during ratification, but then sort of died away as a big issue until the Civil War and the addition of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. We look to the United States Constitution, the 14th Amendment, which is on page 10 and 11. Section 5 of the 14th Amendment. Congress shall have the power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. And what did that article add? Section 1 defines citizenship for the first time, but fills in privileges and immunities clauses, due process clause, and equal protection clause. Then gives Congress the power to enforce by appropriate legislation. A huge grant of authority to the United States Congress. And it has been the 14th Amendment that has been the vehicle for limiting what states can do in combination with the Supremacy Clause. And if the federalism balance has shifted, that's the text that made it happen. There's a lot of political answers to why the power balance has shifted as well. In times of war and emergency, we just hear a huge suck of power to the national government. In times of relative calm, we hear arguments for decentralization, the new federalism, as President Nixon called it, for example. So fluid relationships always between the United States Constitution and the Oregon Constitution. Okay, we're now going to dive into the Oregon Constitution in more detail, and I'm going to turn it over to Dave to talk about separation of powers and what the various branches are allowed to do and not allowed to do under this constitutional scheme.
Thank you. I am Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. I'm going to talk a little bit about Article 3, which is the separation of powers provision in the Oregon Constitution. I'm going to make a couple of comments on what Justice Leeson has already talked about. The Bill of Rights, the one thing you have to look at that and recognize is that the Bill of Rights is essentially a limitation on the power of government as to certain things. As Justice Leeson pointed out, under the Oregon Constitution, you as legislators have about full authority to legislate on anything you want to. And the Bill of Rights in the Oregon Constitution is important because it says there are certain things you cannot do. Some of these provisions are actually written in terms of no law may be passed, a direct instruction to the legislature that this is someplace you cannot go. Others get there in a more indirect route. For instance, the prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures. Well, that's primarily aimed at the executive branch that, for instance, using the police power, they can't do unreasonable searches. But it's equally true that if you tried to draft a law that authorized the executive branch to engage in unreasonable searches, it would also be unconstitutional. So the Bill of Rights, putting it up front, I think was really an effort to say, these are limits on what you can do, and then we're going to tell you how we're going to set you up, and we're going to give you a lot of other rules about how you're going to operate. But the first thing you need to know is these are places you cannot go. So they are very, very important in the structure of the document. It was basically a way for the people who enacted the Constitution to say there are certain places where government's powers are going to be restricted. In looking at the three branches of government and looking at the powers that they have, I think that I'm going to start with the judicial power because we're talking about constitutional law, and the judicial power has a specific connection with the Constitution that's unique. Justice Leeson already referred to the fact that the ability to judge the meaning of the Constitution has traditionally, since 1787, been treated as being a power of the judicial branch. And there was a very famous case that all first-year law students are required to read, usually in their first week of constitutional law, called Marbury v. Madison, in which the very question was raised, because it wasn't really clarified in the U.S. Constitution about whose authority it was going to be to decide who would decide what the Constitution meant. I think it was pretty clear from all the debates that had come down during the Constitutional Convention where that was going to come up. But as might be expected, right off the bat, there was a battle between the executive branch and the judicial branch about who it was who was going to get to decide that very issue. And the Supreme Court, maybe not too surprisingly, being that they were the judicial branch, said, no, determining the meaning of the Constitution is our job. That is our function. And it is perhaps the biggest, the most important function performed by the judicial branch. You may remember Judge Landau, some of you were here when they did their presentation on statutory interpretation, noted that the court's business, the 75% of what the courts do these days in the appellate divisions anyway, up in the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, is interpret statutes, try to determine what it is the legislature meant to do with a given piece of statutory language. That is a huge part of their job nowadays, is just trying to interpret what it is the legislature intended to do. And if the legislature looks at what the court says, has said, and they look at it and say, well, that's not really what we meant to do, the legislature always has the ability to come back in those cases and say, well, let's repass a new law, make it clear, and tell the court that's not what we meant, and you can change whatever that decision was. Those decisions that they make in those cases are wide open for further review by the legislature. Now, you compare that with a situation in which a law is challenged as being unconstitutional. If you have a law in front of the Supreme Court and they say this law is unconstitutional, the only response that the legislature can make is to refer out a constitutional amendment to the people to try to react or to change that result. So it's a very important power for the courts to be able to say we're the ones who are the keeper of the flame, basically, with respect to what the meaning of the Constitution is. There have been debates over this, even in Oregon judicial history, with respect to this very question about whether or not there might not be some role. There was I was talking to Justice Leeson when we were getting ready for this about a couple of cases I read from back in the 40s and 50s once when I was looking at some other issue where the Supreme Court was looking at a statute that had been passed that attempted to say that, I think it was 60 days after trial or something, would meet the constitutional requirement of a speedy trial. 60 days from indictment to trial would meet the constitutional requirement for a speedy trial. And it was interesting because in writing the first opinion, the Supreme Court kind of suggests, well, maybe the legislature should have some role in deciding what the speedy trial provision in the Constitution means. Maybe they should have some role with respect to trying to define what does or does not meet that requirement. And it's like that opinion lasted for about a month before they issued a second opinion on the same case on reconsideration, said, wait a minute, what were we thinking of? This cannot be. That is our role. And they basically said, no, whatever the Constitution means, it means, and we will be the ones who determine it. And they have never, since that time, as far as I know, basically even suggested that there was any role for the legislature.
What was the name of that case? Do you remember?
I could dig it out for you. I don't have it off the top of my head. But
that was that reconsideration was our Marbury versus Madison case?
Yeah, it was almost a little bit going down that road. And as Justice Leeson points out, I mean, there is an argument to be said for the legislature to have some role in it, and they do it differently. But it's such a crucial piece.
But I would emphasize that the Oregon Supreme Court exercised the power of what's called judicial review soon after adoption of the Constitution. It was never in question that it was the province of the judicial branch to give final interpretation to the Constitution. The question that came up in that one case was whether that power could be shared in some way. but it didn't establish judicial review for the first time, and I'm going to remember the name of it before we're done here. Oh, I'm going to call you at 3 in the morning. So
I have it in my
phone. It's a little interesting. That's a real threat.
Every now and then I'll bump up against something in the statutes I'm reading, or I'll bring it up too. I mean, there's a couple of statutes that refer to the a specific constitutional provision. I think it's the lucrative office one, where the legislature would attempt to pass a law that actually said they create an office and they'd say this office isn't a lucrative office for the purposes of the constitutional provision. I was going, yeah, they're not going to pay much attention. The court is not going to pay much attention to that when they get that. You can try, but it's not going to gain you very much. So that is the crucial aspect of the judicial power. I mean, certainly there are other things involved in what it is that the courts do that's very important. But I would say the one where they have the greatest impact, and also one of the most important, because our government is a government of checks and balances. The fear always was in adopting constitutions that if the legislature, say, if they, for instance, were not only the one who passes the law, i.e. has the legislative power, but also had the ability to say what the Constitution meant, that would basically put the legislature in a position where they could ignore the Constitution. That was the fear. The fear being that if you could say, oh, I'm going to pass this law and we declare that it doesn't violate the Bill of Rights provision on unreasonable searches and seizures, well, how then is there ever going to be a way to check that power, to be able to say, no, the Constitution doesn't mean that. There has to be a third independent arbiter of those types of decisions, or the legislature would indeed become very powerful at that point. The issue between the executive branch and the legislative branch usually are issues relating to whether or not the executive branch is exercising legislative powers. Those are ones that we deal with a lot, where there are questions about rulemaking and whether or not that constitutes exercise of legislative power. Every now and then we get into a little bit of an issue with the legislature and the powers they exercise, not very often. Very, very seldom do we have issues come up about the legislature exercising executive powers. It comes up primarily. The only time I can think of when it comes up is every now and then the legislature will create a body, and they'll have legislative appointments to the body where we say the president can appoint one member and the House can appoint one member. And they're almost always inevitably advisory bodies, which is fine. If all that the body's going to do is make advice to the legislature or to the executive, they don't really exercise governmental power, so we don't have a problem with those types of committees. The times where it's come up as a problem on occasion is where the legislature comes back a session or two later and says, well, we've got this body that already exists. Why don't we go ahead and let them, for instance, make decisions about grants of money or something like that, things that clearly are executive branch functions. And suddenly a body that you set up that was fine, did not violate any issues of the legislature exercising executive branch functions, suddenly you have the problem. And that has happened at least once in the last 40 or 50 years, where we've had that happen, where it's easy to take an existing body and say, well, let's let them go do something that really is an executive branch, but they forget the membership includes legislative bodies. Now, the other side of the coin is the executive branch exercising legislative power, and this is always a contentious issue, because what we're talking about here is delegation of your power, the legislative power, to executive branch agencies. And there was a time, back starting in the 30s and 40s, when the courts put pretty strict limitations on the ability of the legislature to delegate power over to the agencies. They would insist that the legislature provided standards, for instance, for the exercise of that power, to say how the agency was going to adopt rules, the nature of the rules, what kind of standards they went through. Over time, that has fallen away quite a bit. And I think part of it is because of a recognition of reality about what it means when the executive branch enforces the laws. As a practical matter, every time you pass a law and tell an agency to do something, you're giving them some legislative power. Because you cannot enforce the law. There's no way we can write laws so detailed that it addresses all of the policy issues that an agency has to address in the process of enforcing that law. They have to make decisions. And when they make decisions, i.e. policies, they're making rules and they're engaging in a legislative function. It's inevitable. Even when those cases came down in the 30s, those were just pretty much ignoring probably the reality of what was going on, because so many of the things that the agencies did require policy-making decisions. And what the newer cases have come around to doing is saying, look, you can go ahead and do these things. You can exercise these legislative powers so long as you use a procedure that adequately gives people notice and opportunity to be heard, and basically to come in and try to influence your decision under this delegated power that the legislature has given to you. So, you know, these are tough issues. Rulemaking in particular over the year has generated a ton of work for me, because I've always done the administrative law drafting, and there is always the concern that agencies are not subject to adequate control by the legislature, for instance, that there should be more responsibility for the legislature to overrule a rule if they feel it's not within the scope and intent of the enabling legislation. But there are processes in place to do that already. I mean, anybody can bring an action. I say anybody, but that's a little open to question anymore. Can bring a civil action to challenge a rule and claim it's not within the scope and intent. And people do. We get lots of lawsuits over time where people can come in and say, we think this rule isn't what the legislature authorized. And they have that ability and they use it. Our office reads all the rules and we write reports with respect to rules that come forward that we think are not within the scope and intent of the enabling legislation.
And then what is the standard is it arbitrary and capricious, the same as the, what is the standard for throwing out a regulation?
It is essentially, the principal one on a rule is simply whether or not it's within the authority of the agency, whether it's within the scope and intent of the enabling legislation. So what they look at is they look to see, once you say to agency A, go do this, whether or not what they're doing is in fact promoting the goals that are expressed in that legislation. They're deferential, I will say that. I think courts are fairly deferential to the rulemaking power. The ones where agencies clearly get in trouble are where they try to enact a rule that's contrary to one of the specific statutes, and that does happen, where you can look at a statute and the statute says, you know, this is the way it's going to be, and the agency adopts a rule that is completely in conflict with that, then that's a no-brainer. At that point, the rule's invalid.
And these challenges are brought where? In circuit court?
They're brought in the Court of Appeals.
That's the Court of Original Jurisdiction for a regulatory challenge?
Excuse me?
Is that the Court of Original Jurisdiction for a regulatory?
Agency itself gets to decide, and then the review is to the Court of Appeals. And one of the methodologies that the courts have come up with is they look at the nature of the statute. Does it, by its terms, delegate to the agency the responsibility to fill in the blanks, mm-hmm. or is the thought complete in itself? And then they will look at the rules that are adopted depending on what kind of a statute is being implemented.
Then the last thing I'd...
Senator Whitsitt, Jim?
Chair Burdick, Justice Leeson, along those lines, one of the things that disturbs me is the morass of legal proceedings you have to get through before you can actually get to a judge, and that's one of the ways that the various agencies protect their rulemaking authority, in my opinion. Take the land use planning, for instance. You have all the rules and regulations that go with LCDC, and we've created another land use board of appeals that you have to go through before you can ever get to that court of appeals. Unless you're a very wealthy person, it becomes almost impossible to ever reach a judge to get judicial relief.
And that is, Senator Whitsitt, by matter of statute, correct?
Yes.
That structure has been set up by the legislature.
Yes.
I actually...
You met the enemies, us.
Yeah. Actually,
the enemies, us.
And I actually did draft the bill this time that would turn to the end of the... to a Court of Appeals, essentially. I mean, the legislature does have the ability, of course, to go back and review... None of those pieces of the puzzle are really constitutional at all. They're statutory and, you know, goes with the whole history of some of these issues about how the law has developed over time. So they can be changed.
But on the Land Use Board of Appeals, the Land Use Board of Appeals is a court. I mean, that is the court of original jurisdiction for a land use appeal. And then appeals from that go to the Court of Appeals, just like appeal from circuit court. It's a substitute for circuit court because it's specialized.
Mm-hmm. As I understand it, that it's an extra court in that if you were to appeal a regular decision from an agency, it would go to the Court of Appeals. It wouldn't have to go through another court process.
Yeah.
It's a whole other layer. Another question?
Yes, please.
Regarding amendments to the Constitution, there seems to be quite a difference in the procedures for amending the state and federal Constitution. As I understand it, the federal Constitution, there's certainly no one subject involved in an amendment, given, you know, the 14th Amendment has four distinct subjects, whereas Oregon requires that you have only one distinct subject. In the federal law, it's set up so that it requires two-thirds majority of both houses of Congress or two-thirds of the state legislatures to initiate an amendment and three-fourths to ratify it. Whereas under the initiative process, you can get one person with a good idea, a few signatures, and a majority plus one, which is democracy at its worst, and you have an amendment to your Constitution, some places that are 10 or 12 pages long. And then that becomes very difficult for the legislature to overturn. A statutory initiative can be overturned by the legislature with will. But without that, once it's an amendment, then you have to go through the two-thirds. It's not an equal procedure anymore. Would you discuss that?
Go ahead.
This kind of moves down to item four, but I will go ahead and discuss it. And these are, of course, things that are by the terms of the Constitution, either by reason of the original language of the Constitution or the amendments that have been made over time. The initiative provision came in 1902. And at that point, it was the height of direct democracy movement in Oregon. And we were one of the leaders in the nations on this. California was Johnny Come Lately with respect to the initiative powers. And, of course, not all states have it. I mean, we were one of the very first ones to come forward with this concept, the ability of the people to directly initiate changes, especially changes in the Constitution, which is the fundamental document.
Before you move on to that point, I'd like to convene the Judiciary Committee as a full committee for our record. Thank you. Hope you didn't lose your thought.
Not a problem. The developments that have occurred over the last 10 or 15 years with respect to the Constitution has been to look closer at the specific language of those provisions that address the manner in which the Constitution can be amended or changed. And the big distinction that has become front and center, and it was not front and center for many, many years. These are issues that were raised and until they first came up in the Armada case, which was one that challenged the Crime Victims Initiative. These were issues that were there but just had never been brought up. And the issue was the meaning, how much could you do in the initiative? That's what it came down to. If you were going to initiate a change to the Constitution, how much could you do? And frankly, Justice Leeson's the expert here, but I think she's probably a little reluctant to talk. I mean, she was involved with that decision. But the bottom line is that the initiated changes essentially are limited to doing an amendment. And an amendment is treated as being a single change to the Constitution, and the test that they came up with was simply this, that if a voter looking at this proposed change to the Constitution could see two changes, two different things, and might vote differently on one, rather than the other, that that was not a single amendment, that that was two amendments. And the Victims' Right Initiative was a classic example of that, the one that brought this whole issue fore and center, because the Victims' Right measure changed several different provisions of the Constitution. It changed the, how many votes you needed for a conviction of murder. It changed certain provisions on the right against self-incrimination. It changed certain provisions relating to what was an unreasonable search and seizure. I forget what they're. There was a long laundry list. Clearly, several different provisions were
affected.
Eight
of them, actually. Eight provisions.
Eight provisions. And after the court came down with them on and said, no, this was not a single amendment, it came back to the legislature, who, and as many of you know, who were here for these, for those long floor sessions on these individual measures, of the ones that got referred out, the solution was simple, break it down to individual amendments and send it back out to the voters. That's what the legislature did, and of those, three, I believe, failed after the election, basically more or less validating what the court was saying, that if these things had not been presented as a package, take it or leave it, that the voters might very well choose differently on the different pieces, the different amendments that were being proposed. And, you know, the legislature had similar sort of rules to prevent the same, very same thing. It's underneath the old term of log ruling, the concept that, you know, you may not like what I've got in my bill. Tell you what, what if I stick something else in here that you like, and we'll manage to work it out so there's, you know, that everybody can find something they like in this bill and really want, even though there are certain things they want. We actually have rules as well ensconced in the single subject requirement that are intended to prevent that. In the Constitution, they have the same sort of concept, the idea that the voters should not be asked to vote for some things in order to get them, even though there are other amendments they may not like so much. So that's where we're at on initiated amendments. Now, the legislature has a different set of rules. They have their own provision up in Article 17 of the Oregon Constitution that sets out a different concept. By the way, one of the consequences of the Armada decision and of the way the Constitution is written is that voters cannot initiate a revision. You cannot do there's no mechanism for doing more than one amendment through initiated measure. Only the legislature can start up a revision. And in order to do that, they need to get a two-thirds vote in both chambers to do more than one amendment in the same measure referred out. If they do that, they can send it out and they can, in fact, attempt to do a revision. Otherwise, as you well know, it's a simple amendment. If it's a single amendment, they can do it by a simple majority vote for a referral to the people. Puts a lot of pressure on our office because that test, although it sounds simple, is very difficult in looking at some individual proposals. When you start talking about matters properly connected therewith, it gets a little hazy sometimes, and we do the best we can. We don't get to dictate either. If the Supreme Court later says we're wrong, we'll find out the hard way when it gets to the court, but we do our best to try to advise when we think something's a revision, something's an amendment. Talking about the judicial branch and talking about the judicial branch and the separation of powers, I'm going to lead back here to interpretation of that. The judicial branch, sometimes you will hear being accused of legislating. You know, now obviously that would be outside of their scope of power. With respect to that, I mean, the real question is when are they moving ahead of where they should be, where the legislature is, where their role is. I think I'll turn it back over to the Justice Leeson here to talk a little bit about courts as the reactive branch and how they look at the various issues that come up with what their proper role is.
Courts, unlike you, are in the position of reacting. You can hold hearings, examine a problem, work proactively to change public policy. Courts do not act until they have a case and controversy in front of them, brought by two parties with adverse interests, and for the most part the parties define the nature of the controversy and the theory on which it is going to be resolved. And I say for the most part because there's one exception. the court has adopted a rule that says parties cannot force the courts into an interpretation of the Constitution if a statute will solve the problem. An example is a case brought by a person arguing that Article 1, Section 14 of the Oregon Constitution on bailable offenses entitled him to bail in his case. And the court said, don't have to go there. You win under ORS 135-285 sub 2. If there is a complete answer to a litigant's question in his favor that is statutory and obviates the need to interpret the Constitution, the court will take what's called the first door out, the statutory door out. Beyond that, the court looks at constitutional challenges based on the nature of the arguments posed. In Armada, I think it was the first time that Article 17 had been raised as a way of interpreting what could be done by initiative with respect to amendments to the Oregon Constitution. Article 17 has been there forever, 1857, almost forever, but hadn't been an active subject of litigation until a creative lawyer puts in front of the court, but what about this provision? Courts don't go looking for that kind of work. If you will, that's where the judicial activism issue becomes so interesting. Courts don't impose their own theories. They respond to the theories that the parties raise. Courts have also come up with methodologies, and I'm sure you've just had this methodology stuff drilled into you at this point, to almost wanting to gag. But when we go out looking at a provision of the Constitution, we don't just say, what sounds interesting today? In Priest versus Peirce, the court sat out the drill it's going to go through when a constitutional matter is in front of it. In Ecumenical Ministries, it set out the drill it's going to go through in looking at the meaning of an initiative. In PGE versus Boley, it set out the drill it's going to go through in determining the intent of the legislature in enacting a statute. And courts act, I think, quite well within those confines. The advantage of a collegial body of judges at the appellate level is if one of us thinks another has gotten out of bounds, that's the point of the collegial dialogue. They're called back and either having to change the methodology or conform the analysis to that methodology. So that's the process, at least, that is followed in constitutional interpretation. I think someone had a question. No? Okay.
Question free at the moment. Did you have more, Dave?
I certainly can.
I didn't want to interrupt a thought, but I wanted to ask you, you said that our Constitution was kind of modeled after Indiana, Maine, and Iowa. And I'm just wondering if those are all fairly conservative states. And I was just wondering if they have anything even close to Article 1, Section 8 in those constitutions, which is our free speech.
Senator Burdick, Article 1, Section 8 was lifted from Indiana.
And has that remained intact over the years?
Yes.
Have they had the same issues, do you know, in Indiana?
And I think when you ask if they had the same issues, we're getting into the matter now of whether when the United States Supreme Court announces the meaning of something, has it established the maximum right, or has it established the minimum? And in Oregon and the courts have been a leader in saying the federal constitution establishes the floor, state constitutions can establish a ceiling, if you will.
Right.
And Article 1, Section 8, because it contains language that is not present. Or let me rephrase that. As Justice Gilletta says, the language is English. It contains wording that is not present in the First Amendment.
Right.
The Oregon courts have interpreted it as then having a different meaning than the First Amendment Free Speech Clause.
Right.
I think there's a great deal of justification for that because, as discussed, the model of the U.S. Constitution was there, and except for those original 13 states, all the states that came in afterwards adopted their constitutions at that later date. And the question then arises, if you were going to adopt something that you wanted to be exactly the same as the U.S. Constitution, why would you adopt such different language from that which appears in the U.S. Constitution? Why would you do a Bill of Rights that used language that was so different? And the the difficult thing about it is that there was a lot of this copycat aspect of it. I mean, and when Justice Leeson says it's, well, because they came from Indiana, it was even, I think, more a case that they had a copy of a
witness. They had the copy of a witness.
They had a copy, and they didn't have a copy of New York's or... You know,
and some people had a copy of the Iowa Constitution, and somebody had a copy of the Maine Constitution, and it was a very practical convention.
Well, more of a comment on this whole line. I mean, we look at a snapshot back in time. Historically, we have to look at what was going on at that time as to what they may have been wanting to provide for their citizens within their boundaries, mm-hmm. as compared to what was already been the threshold for mm-hmm. On the federal level. And so there was some conscious effort, as I think has been brought out. And I don't know if I would say, quote unquote, Indiana or those other states were conservative at the time as much as being protectionist for their local control.
Yeah, at one time, it's interesting in looking at interpretation. At one time, our courts used to go, the first thing they'd do when they'd have a case on, say, the Bill of Rights, and they didn't have any cases on it, used to be that the first thing they'd do is go look and see what Indiana courts had done. Mm-hmm. with this. Mm-hmm. And I think they may still look a little bit, but I don't think they give it as much as they might have at one time, because they might look at it to see if the reasoning sounded good or if there's some argument they hadn't thought of.
We'll look to Indiana for interpretation of the provision at the time.
At the time.
And then it becomes Oregon's, and our interpretation becomes ours.
You also said something I was a little confused. Maybe I misunderstood, but you said that it's up to the states to determine whether the federal, if the federal, say, in the Bill of Rights area, if the federal list should be a ceiling or a floor. I thought that the federal requirements were always a floor.
Or the floor. That's what I meant.
That was non-negotiable.
No, that's just the floor.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the Supremacy Clause. The
Correct.
Supremacy Clause basically says the U.S. Constitution always wins.
Well, it always wins unless ours provides more protection
individual free speech is the great area where the U.S. Supreme Court has said obscenity is not speech.
Right.
And in Oregon we've said any subject whatever.
Right. So, but that can be argued to be more protective
of individual rights. More protective of the right to speak,
therefore,
yes.
It takes supremacy over the federal requirement, because the federal requirement is a floor when it comes to that area.
And one of the interesting things that's happened, I think, over the last 15 or 20 years again, is a much more emphasis on looking at the situation in 1857, the historical analysis. We didn't talk about this a little bit under four.
Well, when we were talking about interpretive methodology, I understand Judge Landau and Judge Brewer went through this with you, but just by way of refresher, if you will, the goal is to figure out what was the intent of the drafters, and some people would argue the voters, when they adopted the original Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the method for getting there is to look at the wording of the provision and the text, the context in which that text appears. If there's case law surrounding it that might illuminate it, the courts will look to that. I've run into too many situations where the case law is contradictory and utterly unhelpful. And then we look to the historical circumstances that led to the creation of the provision. Now, that can lead you on a very interesting historical journey. If, for example, Article 1, Section 8 was taken from the Indiana Constitution and there was no debate about it, what do we know then about the historical circumstances? And that will lead us back to see, well, what were the historical circumstances in Indiana? And then we learn that Indiana had lifted it, and back we go to almost a regression into history, trying to find the first time the phrase appeared, what were the concerns at that time. So it's a very difficult analysis. The goal always is to try to resolve these cases as a matter of the words themselves. We're always hoping that texts are clear. When it comes to interpreting provisions of the Constitution adopted by the initiative process, compound Senator Whitsitt's frustration and mine. There, the problem is, what did the voters intend? Well, another exercise in madness if one is not careful. We always again look to the text and context. What's frustrating with so many of the initiatives is they are not drafted with the care that legislation coming out of the legislature is drafted, and there's not the opportunity for the debate and the subtle refinements and the exchange of opinions. Somebody has an idea, they draft an initiative. Nonetheless, the question is, what is the goal of the or intent of the voters in adopting that particular wording? So again, we look to the text, we look at the context of the wording of the ballot measure, whether there were related ballot measures. The history of the provision can be very problematic when looking at initiatives and can lead to very intriguing debates among judges about what is relevant history. Certainly, what's in the voter's pamphlet is relevant. What about television advertisements, newspaper editorials, public debates, so on? There becomes pretty controversial in trying to sort out what did the people intend when they adopted this particular provision. But that's the methodology that courts use depending on whether it's an original provision of the Constitution or one that has been amended by initiative.
On initiatives, the one thing I'd add on that is that it seems like so often the issues we struggle with in this building are not issues that are ever discussed in the initiative process, because so seldom does the language itself really get debated very much as it goes through the initiative process. Instead, it's the big concept that gets debated. And consequently, there is no discussion of some of the questions about the specific meaning of some of the language in the initiatives. And I always felt sorry for the courts on these cases because they don't have the option of saying, we're going to punt on this one. They have to decide at some point what it means, because they will get the case, they will have to decide, and they will have to do the best they can, and they will probably have to rely just on the text to try to figure out what that is, because there will not be any sort of quote-unquote legislative history to help them out.
That's a good point. Thank you. Are there questions? We could go on all afternoon. I really appreciate you being here. Was there any closing points you wanted to make before you leave? Or
our goal was to do the overview, have the conversation. I think we've done that, and you have very important work to turn to.
Well, we really appreciate your coming, and I was especially pleased that you were able to come when there was an actual law-oriented class in the audience, so I appreciate that very much. I will be back with you with feedback.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, we will now open a work session on Senate Bill 278. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 278 was before the committee on February 14th. The bill defines who may act as a personal representative of a deceased individual for purposes of access to protected health information records under Oregon's HIPAA statutes. There was a -1 amendment requested at the time of the hearing, and that amendment is before you in your packet. The amendment clarifies that the measure applies to both decedents without court-appointed personal representatives ever, as well as decedents for whom the court had previously appointed a personal representative, but for which that personal representative had subsequently been discharged. The bill comes to us from the Oregon State Bar's Health Law Section.
Thank you. I think it was a member of this committee that caught that. Appreciate the discovery that we needed the -1 amendment, because it's clear we needed it. Is there discussion? Well, Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 278.
Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 278. Is there discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 278 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 278 as amended to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Would you like to carry this? I'll carry this. Okay. Now we will move into a public hearing on Senate Bill 219. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 219 would amend ORS 190.420 and the following statutes in that chapter. This regards the authority of the Attorney General to exempt classes of agreements between state agencies and agencies of other states. Currently, the Attorney General must do a review of all such agreements, and this proposal would give the Attorney General the authority to exempt classes of agreements of, as well as form agreements concerning interstate agreements with other agencies.
Okay, we have signed up for this, Stephanie Smythe. Hope I pronounced that correctly.
Thank you, Senator Burdick. That was perfect.
Good. Welcome to the committee.
I have some materials that are being handed out. It's a one-page brief synopsis because it's a very brief bill. I am the attorney in charge of the...
You need to give your name again.
I'm sorry. My name is Stephanie Smythe, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. I am the attorney in charge of the business transactions section at the Oregon Department of Justice. We help state agencies with their contracts. And among those are the interstate agreements that are the subject of this bill. ORS 190.430 is the statute being amended, and it requires that the Attorney General review interstate agreements before they take effect. Interstate agreements are the agreements between the state of Oregon and public agencies in other states. The Attorney General currently has only two options for exempting such agreements from review, and that is where they are either research agreements or student or faculty exchange agreements. We encountered in the course of reviewing such agreements for the Oregon University system a situation where some very simple, non-technical interstate agreements were repeatedly before us for review, and those were athletic contest agreements where a state team ventures to another state and agrees to engage in an athletic contest. There were no reasons, really, that we would need to review such agreements. The obligations on either side are essentially to engage in the game. We thought that that would be something that was very appropriate to exempt, but unfortunately our hands were tied. In the international agreement area, which is another subject covered by the same chapter in ORS, there is no limit on the exemptions that the Attorney General may grant. So in this bill, we propose to grant the same authority to the Attorney General for interstate agreements as the Attorney General has for international agreements.
So this language is the same as it appears in the international agreements?
It is almost identical. In the drafting process, a word was changed, but I think that the effect is the same. In 190.490, the language is the Attorney General may exempt certain agreements, comma, classes of agreements or form agreements from the requirement that the agreement be approved. And in the bill before you, the Attorney General may exempt agreements, comma, including classes of agreements and form agreements. But I think the effect of the wording in both is the same.
What are the consequences? The Attorney General just completely runs wild and fails to review an agreement that should be reviewed. What are the consequences of that?
The agreement would take effect if the Attorney General was asked to review it and did not review it within 30 days. That would be the tantamount to approving it. That's the way that these two statutes are written for international and interstate agreements. So if the agreement were submitted to us and we didn't review it within 30 days, it would be deemed approved. It would take effect.
Okay. So the statute itself doesn't require... it says the agreement shall be submitted to the Attorney General before taking effect. So... If they are submitted to him and he doesn't review it and it goes into effect and then somebody has a problem with that and comes back, I guess that's what I was trying to get at. is this too broad? Will things fall between the cracks that should get reviewed?
No, I don't think so, because the Attorney General in the first place would look at either the individual agreements or the classes of agreements and make a determination that the risk to the state was such that it did not need to have review by the Attorney General's office. An exemption wouldn't happen otherwise.
Okay, and the way I read this, and just to confirm this with you, this in no way limits the Attorney General's ability to review any agreement.
That's correct? An interstate or interstate agreement? That's correct.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
This does not grant the exemption, in other words.
Okay, thank you. Senator Whitson?
Madam Chair, once that exemption has been granted, then does the Attorney General still have the right to review?
It depends on the way that the exemption letter is written. And in the exemption letters that our office writes, it is common to say that we may at any time say that we want to review an individual agreement or classes of agreements that are subject to the exemption, and that the exemption may be modified or revoked at any time.
Should this legislation include such language so that it's made very clear that it's not just your letter, but it's part of the statute? It disturbs me that we're removing some what I consider pretty essential checks and balances here.
Chair Burdick and Senator Whitsett, I wouldn't have that concern. We do have a large number of exemptions that we've granted, not just under these statutes, but under others, and it is common for us to retain those controls. I would say that if it is stated here but not in other statutes that grant us exemption authority, then it would imply that we may not have that same option with respect to other exemptions. So I think it is best to just leave it unstated.
Thank you. Senator Pisanski.
Senator Whitsett, again, did you follow that? In other words, we have to go to every statute that has this type of stuff in it, and we'd have to actually explicitly put it in the statute, or they could take the position that the legislature was specifically giving it in this, and because we didn't do it in the others, we were intelligently not including it as part of the statute. It seems it wouldn't be that way, but that's the way these things have been interpreted. Too bad the judges left.
I know. Then we'd have to have the Omnibus Exemption Act. Did you catch that the
I understand. I understood Senator Pozanski's description of that, I believe. I was wondering if we could, from the witness, get an example or two of other statutes that provide such exemptions.
In ORS Chapter 291, there's a whole separate set of statutes that actually require state agencies to submit agreements to the Attorney General for review. And in those statutes, there is an exemption, there is the authority given to the Attorney General to exempt form agreements or classes of agreements from review. The other example would be in 19490, which is not addressed by this bill, Senate Bill 219, which has just very general language that says the Attorney General may exempt international agreements from review.
Senator Pisanski.
So basically what this bill would allow is that the Attorney General's office, and in particular at this point in time, your section, just determined that these type of agreements were basically just a workload costing the agency that brings it to you, in this case OUS, money for you to review something that is pretty standard operating procedure. You'd cut down on your caseload, you cut down on the cost for those services, but you'd always have that, if you had it in your letter, the ability to review any particular agreement that might be coming before you, or again the classification of agreements that would be contemplated under here.
That's right.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Thank you very much. Why don't you stand by? I'd like to kind of get a sense. I am comfortable with this bill, and I would like to move it on its merry way unless I see distress from the silent majority here on the committee. Senator Byard, did you have any comments on this bill?
kind of ambivalent about it. I'm trying to figure out what else it does.
Okay, I think it's a fairly short bill. So at this time, is there other questions from the committee? I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 219, and I think I'll just take a gamble here and open a work session on Senate Bill 219. Senator Starr?
Yes, Senator. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 219 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 219 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? So ordered. Senate Bill 219 is on its way to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Beyer, would you like to carry this after you research it?
Not really.
Okay. Senator Brzezinski has volunteered. Okay, that completes our agenda. I remind you that March 17th is getting closer. Actually, March 16th, as we prepare for our trip to Pendleton. And so we will be filling in with more details as we get them. So with that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.